It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
We are one nation under God, and we can become one nation unified.
Roy Moore beat Alabama Senator Luther Strange by a margin of nearly 10 points in Tuesday's runoff election. His victory comes despite the president's support for Strange during the primary.
Don't let anybody in the press think that because he supported my opponent that I do not support him and support his agenda.
President Trump says he'll now support Moore in the December 12 general election as he faces Democrat Doug Jones. Mr. Trump deleted his tweets of support for Luther Strange and this morning wrote, "Spoke to Roy Moore of Alabama last night for the first time. Sounds like a really great guy who ran a fantastic race. He will help to make America great again."
The political seas, the political winds in this country right now are very hard to navigate.
In his concession speech, Senator Strange thanked the president for his support during the primary.
And if this causes him any trouble, it's not his fault. The fault always lies in the candidate or the head coach or the guy who's holding the ball. And that's my responsibility.
Moore, who displayed a revolver during a campaign speech and rode to the polls on horseback, is favored to win the general election in this solidly red state. But the campaign may be far from over.
You can never take any election for granted. Ask Hillary Clinton. So I think inevitably the Republicans will spend a lot of money and time to make absolutely certain their base votes.
Former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon, who supported Moore in the primary, says he plans to help similar insurgents around the country, but it's conviction, not cash, that drives the populist base. Bannon says his efforts are intended to support, not hurt, the president's agenda.
I told you all last night that a vote for Judge Roy Moore is a vote for Donald J. Trump.
But with such a slim majority in the Senate, populist attacks on the Republican establishment, including Mitch McConnell, may cause trouble for the majority leader as he attempts to unify Republicans on health care, tax reform, and other legislation.
All right, that's what happened. I think Judge Moore won 63 of 67 counties. Daniel Horowitz has a really good article about this race in Alabama, in which he observes that the issue here wasn't that people were voting against the establishment. Now, of course they were. That was, of course, a big part of it. We're going to talk about that. But also they were voting for the values that Judge Moore is not ashamed to express. People are tired of Republicans running and dodging from the moral issues, equivocating, being embarrassed about them, and they're thirsty for someone who will actually, without compromise, talk about the things that they believe are really true. And so I think Daniel's right. Well, by the way, we'll put his article on our Facebook page, "The Audacity of Hope: Alabama Voters Trusted Godly Values and Roy Moore." We'll put that on our Facebook page so that you can read it. But joining me now is someone who really threw their hat in this ring, and that's Senate Conservatives Fund, led by Ken Cuccinelli. Ken is the former Attorney General of the state of Virginia. He ran for governor there and was one of the lead attorney generals to fight the Obamacare when it first came in. But now he leads Senate Conservatives Fund, who threw their hat in the ring in Alabama. And Ken, this was a great victory, don't you think?
Oh, it's a spectacular victory. And, you know, what doesn't get mentioned, including in y'all's introductory report, is Judge Moore did something I've never seen before. He beat two senators in one day. And I'm not even talking about Mitch McConnell. I'm talking about Bob Corker. Bob Corker retired because of the grassroots insurgency that Judge Roy Moore elucidated, that he demonstrated. Bob Corker in Tennessee, for your listeners' benefit, is the same guy who gave us the Iran deal. He's the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee. And he was going to get roasted in his primary, and he wasn't willing to make his case to the grassroots in Tennessee. Judge Moore didn't just beat Mitch McConnell and Luther Strange in Alabama. He knocked Bob Corker out, too, on the same day. So this is a big step for the grassroots, a big step for conservatives, and it should send two messages to Washington. One, you don't keep your promises, you don't keep your job.
You know,
and two, we need new leadership in the Republican Congress. The whole Mitch McConnell and his gang of five have to go.
Well, I agree with you, Ken. And the interesting thing is, you know, they, meaning leadership, establishment, whatever, were quoted in more than one article before Judge Moore's race on Tuesday, that they were worried about this race because if people actually went for Moore, then many of them would be in trouble. And then there were speculations about retirements. And then before the day was even over, Corker was resigning. So in regard to early retirements, are you hearing any kind of whispers about senators who might be in trouble and who might step down who we weren't expecting to?
Yeah, you know, the whispers that I've heard is that some of the leadership may be talking to some of their incumbents up this year, like Wicker in Mississippi, who's at the moment facing... looks like he may be facing Chris McDaniels again, you know, again, who beat Pat Cochran, but not by enough in Mississippi. Heller, Flake, these people may get little meeting requests to say, hey, maybe we could run somebody else in your place. Because one of the usual Mitch McConnell leadership arguments is that the incumbent is more electable. Well, that's not true in all these cases. It's simply not true. And, you know, Jeff Flake's a great example. Jeff Flake is less electable than any of his potential primary opponents, including his current one. And the same is true of Dean Heller in Nevada. So their usual smear campaign, where they overwhelm a challenger with money, didn't work in Alabama. Now, I appreciate Steve Bannon's efforts and so forth, but the reality in Alabama was part of the reason it didn't work is, as you noted in your introduction, Judge Roy Moore is a known quantity to Alabama voters. They know Judge Moore. They know who he is, and love him or don't, you know this man stands and he fights for his principles, even when it means sacrificing his own job, because he's done it not once, but twice. I mean, how different would Washington be if the Republicans were that committed to the things they say they believe? We'd have a different America.
Absolutely, and I think we really are, Ken, hungry for men of principle. We have just operated in a vacuum for so long. And even, I have to say, I remember when we switched our language to family values, because I understand the political hazards of what I'm going to say here. I'm not from a cabbage patch, but we did throw away the terms, the things that expressed really what we believed about the sanctity of life, about the sanctity of marriage, and we became very cautious, and then we became very murky and unclear. And it's funny to me that the left does not respect equivocation. It's really, even though people that are hardliners like Justice Moore take a big hit and oftentimes lose, people really do respect clarity, and I think that's what he offered. So I think, and that leads to my next question. Well, so then, was the race in Alabama, the Senate race, a fluke, or do you really think this portends a trend in the 2018 election?
No, this really wasn't a fluke. And interestingly, the reason we can be confident of that is because of the president. So here's the president who goes down, and you know, I'm not being overly critical here, but he picked wrong here. And his whole White House team, his political team, should really just be cleaned out. They need a new team there. This was really a poor, poor political decision. And this was not impetuous. This was not him waking up at 3:30 in the morning and grabbing his Twitter account. This was a thought-out decision in the White House, and they chose to get in on behalf of Luther Strange. So what happens? What happens? You have people showing up at Luther Strange's rallies with the president and with the vice president holding up signs that say, "We love you, Mr. President, but you're wrong." And, I mean, it could hardly be more affectionate, you know? And they voted what they believed. They didn't follow President Trump. And, you know, interestingly, Trump guy Ed Martin was on CNN with me two nights ago when this all happened, and he said, to his credit, he said, you know, in the campaign, Donald Trump said, I could shoot somebody on Madison Avenue and my people would stick with me. And as Ed said, we found out that is not true. That is not true. They stuck with the values and the principles embodied in the reasons they voted for Donald Trump, but they did not just blindly follow Donald Trump. That is why this formula is valid nationwide. Mm-hmm. If people were just going to follow Trump because they love him, where else is that going to happen more than Alabama? And it didn't happen.
So
ideas have consequences.
So that when we're looking at these other races coming up, I think, what, there's 16 Senate seats in play? I believe Republican Senate seats.
Oh, no, 30, you got 33 more coming. 25 defended by Democrats, 8 by Republicans.
Okay.
It's an extraordinary map in 2018. And, you know, Senate Conservatives Fund, we'd love to have the help of your listeners, senateconservatives.com. We were Judge Moore's, our members, I want to be really clear, our small donor grassroots members gathered together were Judge Moore's largest outside donor, well over $200,000, and we invested well over $500,000 independently to help Judge Moore. Now, this is not money plays a role. He needs to be able to get his voice out. But the biggest factor was the fact that Judge Roy Moore was an absolute known quantity on that aspect of character that Republican base voters are looking for more than any, and that is, like you said, Sandy, commitment to principle, to stand, and to know they'll go to Washington and stand. And we've seen tons of people go there and not do it before. Nobody has any doubts about Roy Moore.
I'd say most. We've seen most go to Washington and not stand. We hardly have any that survive whatever wave goes on
right.
in D.C., and you and I both have experienced it. I can't even quite describe it. We just have a few minutes left. Unfortunately, always, we have to make things so quick. But Ken, I'm guessing that as you're selecting candidates, and you guys are, you're sort of surmising, you're getting input from locals, I'm sure. Do you not think that in this next cycle, it is people, a mealy-mouthed candidate will not do in any of these races? Would you agree?
Oh, no. It isn't worth. And look, one of the things that separates the Senate Conservatives Fund is the same thing today as when Jim DeMint founded it when he was an outnumbered senator in the U.S. Senate. And that is that we hold our candidates to a standard. And we're the largest full-spectrum conservative PAC in America. We do not leave the social issues behind. And, you know, most of the others just avoid them. And we don't do that. And we have held our high standards right where they are for the duration of our existence. And that's important because we may end up with only 1, 2, 3, 4 candidates we're supporting through an entire election cycle. But you know SCF candidates are going to be the most likely to fight when they get there. People like Ted Cruz and Mike Lee, Rand Paul, these are some of the all-stars that we have helped elect.
Well,
and
I have to say
helped. Lots of people come out and try to take credit. We help them. And
yes.
Then we hope they'll stand tall.
I know that's
and
true.
Those guys have.
Let me just say that Judge Moore was on with me earlier in the week, and he called out Senate Conservatives Fund and praised you guys for the help that you had given. And so God bless you guys, Ken.
That.
Yeah, listen, we're in this together, trying to turn this country around. And I think the victory of Judge Moore on Tuesday was an encouragement to all of us, and now we just have to roll up our sleeves and state by state
follow
take on
through.
This. Yeah, Senate
follow
Conservatives
through. Get
Fund.
Get them all the way to Washington.
And Senate Conservatives Fund is a great place for you to go to find out who's running where and who maybe you should put your, if you want to support people from other states, you can look at them as kind of the bellwether. Ken Cuccinelli, thanks a lot. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Sandy, always good to be with you.
Okay, talk to you soon. All right, Sandy Rios in the morning, coming right back.
A Moment of Truth with Gary Bryden, Executive Director of the Association of Independent Methodists.
On March 10, 1913, Harriet Tubman died. A brave ex-slave, she repeatedly risked her life traveling into slaveholding states to bring dozens of fellow slaves north to freedom. She was a gifted speaker and became a popular abolitionist speaker. Her audiences were always captured by her wit and eloquence. She said on one occasion, "I always tell God, I'm going to hold steady onto you, and you have to see me through. Just so long as he wants to use me, he'll take care of me, and when he doesn't want to use me any longer, I'm ready to go." Her faith played a role in her freedom and in securing the freedom of others.
The Association of Independent Methodists, like-minded congregations doing together what can't be done separately. Visit AIM2020.com.
Steve Russo with Real Answers.
There's an unusual custom that began in southern Hungary in the 1980s called love padlocks. The tradition was for couples to clamp padlocks to a wrought iron fence in a narrow street linking the mosque in the city's main square and the magnificent medieval cathedral. It was meant to symbolize their commitment to each other. But after the fence was completely covered and no more padlocks could be added, couples began to attach them to fences and statues in the town center. The custom has gradually spread to several other European countries, each with their own twist to the tradition. How do you express your commitment to someone you love? God did it in the ultimate way for each one of us. He sacrificed his only son Jesus on a cross to pay the penalty for our sin. So how will you demonstrate your commitment to him?
For information on books and other resources by Steve Russo, visit the Real Answers website, realanswers.com.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next. Hi, this is Todd Starnes from Fox News, and one of the things I love about Liberty University is the broad vision they have for their students. Instead of simply preparing them for a career, Liberty helps students grow into mature men and women of character, striving to impact their career fields for Christ. Liberty University is the largest Christian university in the world, offering more than 550 programs of study. Visit liberty.edu to learn more. Again, that's liberty.edu. When it comes to the national anthem, it turns out most Americans agree with President Trump. 85% say they always stand in silence when they sing about the land of the free, the home of the brave. 74% with hand over heart. That's according to a new national poll conducted by Reuters. As for the National Football League, 58% of you folks say players should be required to stand during the Star-Spangled Banner. But when it comes to punishing players who refuse, well, that's where Americans break with the president. 57% say players should not be fired for disrespecting the anthem. But there's another number that might be even more important. It's from Nielsen. NFL ratings are down 11% this year. In other words, NFL players may have a constitutional right to take a knee, but viewers have a constitutional right to change the channel. And they have. I'm Todd Starnes.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Effective immediately, I am canceling the last administration's completely one-sided deal with Cuba.
Yet more than 100 days have passed since President Trump thrilled Little Havana with his vow to restore the sanctions and embargo on Cuba.
You watch what's going to happen.
And nothing has happened. That's because the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, the small overburdened unit that manages sanctions, has not produced the fine print for Mr. Trump's policy shift to be enacted. The announced changes do not take effect until OFAC issues new regulations. OFAC cautioned on July 25th, adding, OFAC expects to issue its regulatory amendments in the coming months. Contacted by Fox News this week, a Treasury spokesman told us, "We don't have a specific date yet for when those revised regulations will be publicly released. We still anticipate," Deputy Assistant Secretary Seth Unger said, "it will be in the coming months."
Yeah, it has not taken effect. That's correct.
Sita Ramachandran, a New York lawyer who specializes in sanctions enforcement law, notes that OFAC's limited resources are no match for a sharp increase in sanctions activity.
New U.S. sanctions bill against Russia, North Korea, and Iran.
President Trump is imposing new financial sanctions against Venezuela.
For Venezuela, President Trump issued an executive order. But in rolling back Cuba policy, Mr. Trump gave a speech.
"We will enforce the ban on tourism."
and issued this national security memorandum to cabinet officers and executive branch agencies, which instructed Treasury and other departments to begin drafting new regulations within 30 days. That happened, but since then, little else has.
Trump could have actually issued an executive order that immediately changed the sanctions program. For example, a couple weeks ago, there was an executive order on Venezuelan sanctions that did not require any implementing regulations by OFAC, but that's not what happened here.
Sandy Rios with you. That was James Rosen on Vox last night. The reason I played that clip is because this is the pattern that we see in agencies, in departments all across Washington, D.C. There are some exceptions, but very few, and that is that the president says what he thinks, he does an executive order, or he sends a directive, and they ignore him. They do nothing. I don't think that there is any place in the government, any particular department that is doing this more than the broad spectrum of national security, where from many reports we're hearing there's just outright ignoring, rebelling, disdain. They have another way of thinking, you see. And so in many cases, you could argue that it's insubordination. But my next guest knows all about this sort of thing because he lived through being part of the Department of Homeland Security. He was one of the founding officers of the Department of Homeland Security. And under the Obama administration, was absolutely isolated and punished because of his work on the Islamic thread, the Islamic connections inside this country. He was so effective that they virtually stole his files, shut him out of his office. He became a whistleblower, wrote a book called See Something, Say Nothing, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Phil Haney.
Good morning, Sandy. I was sitting here listening to your lead-up, and it was like deja vu. I just haven't spent so much time inside the federal government. I was just picturing this process. And there's also kind of a reverse to this whole process, too, and that is how effective they can be when they want to be. Meaning, if they want to implement a policy, you can trust me that they can do it with a snap of the finger. If they don't want to implement a policy, they'll find every imaginable way of slowing things down. Something that should take days and weeks will take months and years. I saw it over and over again.
You know, there's an article in Politico this morning. I'm not sure this is Politico now that I said that. Fox News, actually. 78 of Obama's appointees were burrowed in government. They were moved from political appointees to, you and I understand the language, but our listeners won't. Their political appointees come and go with presidents, but there is a transition that becomes career employees. And they deliberately burrowed 78 of their people in various agencies. They said the most are in Department of Homeland Security and the second most are Department of Justice. What does that mean, Phil, to how our government works?
I can tell you very plainly, I got stung by a creature in the swamp a couple days ago. So it's still very real. I was on a short list of people to meet with Attorney General Sessions. And the organizer of the coming impending meeting was notified that they had concerns about me being on the list. So the organizer said, well, do you know Mr. Haney? Do you know who he is? Yes, we do know who he is, and we have concerns. That is just exactly like what happened when I was still active duty, and I use the term stung because that's exactly what it felt like. It was like one of those creatures crawled up out of the swamp and stung me right on the foot, just like it used to happen all the time when I was active duty. What are the concerns? Who are these people that have the concerns? What gives them the right to take a citizen off of a list to meet with a public elected or appointed official, a secretary of Department of Justice, I should say, attorney general, and just remove them off the list? But that's exactly the way they operate. They don't have to be accountable. They have concerns, which that is a deadly euphemism. When anybody in the administration says they have concerns, hold your breath and get ready, because it's virtually never pleasant. And so it's still going on right now in real life.
Phil, let's turn to the issue that you are, you know a lot of things about a lot of things, but let's turn to the issue that really you wrote your book about and the reason you got marginalized at Homeland Security, and that is the whole issue of the Islamic influence both here in America but also abroad. And you recently returned from a conference in Israel, it's called the Global Counterterrorism Summit. And I think, as I read, there's like 1,500 people there. And so I'm curious about something, Phil. Because we started this segment talking about the disconnect between cabinet officials and the president's stated campaign promises, was the administration part of this counterterrorism summit or not?
No. The only person I saw there that you could connect with the administration was one diplomat. I can't even honestly remember what country she was a diplomat for. But essentially, no, I did not see anything like a representative contingent from America who would come and appear at this global summit, which is considered the best in the world. I mean, this is the preeminent summit on counterterrorism in the whole world. It's been going on every year since 9/11 happened, and it's always around September 11th in a commemoration. You're right, somewhere between 1,200 plus academics, law enforcement, intelligence, diplomatic, and military personnel come together. We have workshops and seminars, and we have discussions about global trends. And no, I didn't see any, defined representation of the law enforcement or counterterrorism community in America while I was there this year.
All right, so I'm assuming because it was in Israel and because you were there and because the administration wasn't there, I'm jumping to a conclusion that this particular group understood the threat of Sharia and Islamic supremacism. Did they? Did you think?
Oh, you sure. You're right. In particular, the one particular workshop I attended was what we call the AFPAC, Afghanistan-Pakistan Arena. The people that put the workshop together that led it were from India, Pakistan, and Israel. And they've had face-to-face dealings with these jihadi groups that are operating in what's called the Indian subcontinent. You're talking Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and Myanmar, also known as Burma. And they were very concerned because they said this area, which is a center of gravity for the global Islamic movement, is completely ignored by counterterrorism specialists in the West. And what was so striking about it is it had a direct connection to the case that I worked on, that I talk about in the book, which is that Tablighi Jamaat initiative that led to the San Bernardino shootings. I stood up in the meeting and talked about the case and how it was eradicated by the U.S. government and then subsequently led to the San Bernardino and the Orlando shootings, both of them, and asked, as a law enforcement officer, counterterrorism specialist in the American federal government, was my concern valid? Did I have a good reason to be focusing on this group? I wish I had my cell phone, because all seven or eight of the panelists nodded their head simultaneously in unison. Yes, you did. And so there it was, right there in the workshop, what specialists from this part of the world who unanimously agreed you had good reason to be concerned about this group. And yet, the federal government shut the case down. And there it was in a nutshell, the whole problem.
Phil, one of the things that you shared with me that you learned in this meeting, it directly affects our new policy in Afghanistan. Remember that the president campaigned on withdrawing troops, and now he's been persuaded by McMaster to add more troops in Afghanistan, and you learned something very significant that might affect that effort, and you need to tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the goals of the new policy that was announced a month or so ago was that they were going to encourage or persuade the Taliban to come and sit at the negotiating table and find some sort of an agreement, peace agreement. Well, what I learned out at the conference was there's a new, I call it Al-Qaeda number 3. It's now called AQIS, Al-Qaeda of the Indian subcontinent. And it has merged together probably some 300 to 500 different jihadi groups that are operating all the way from Afghanistan, clear across the Indian subcontinent, clear to Myanmar, which we've been hearing about lately with the Rohingya people. And they have published a document that your listeners really should look up. It's called the Code of Conduct. You can find it on the web. It's the AQIS, Code of Conduct. It's a 20-page briefing that they wrote on their strategy and tactics based on Quranic principles, not political, from the Quran. And they state plainly what their goals are, which is to find American and Israeli, a.k.a. Zionist, targets anywhere and kill them, and to overthrow the non-Sharia-compliant governments of these mainly five countries that I referred to in the Indian subcontinent, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and Myanmar, and implement a Sharia program, which has always been the goal of al-Qaeda from the very beginning. So you're going to have like a magnetic force drawing people in from all over the world that coalesce and help groups like the Taliban. Now ISIS, what's left of ISIS, has coalesced with Taliban, and they're conducting joint operations in Afghanistan as we speak. That means the battlefield arena for the American soldiers that are going over there is going to be infinitely more complicated and dangerous than it already was. And my question is, do the foreign policy advisors know this? I'm not sure they do, in
Phil,
all honesty.
Well, how could they? If they're not at the conference that you were at, and if the briefings that you and I have sort of taken in this past week are true, which I believe they are, there is such a disconnect. It doesn't seem like the people in charge of our foreign policy decisions in the Trump administration have a grasp, really, of Islam, of Sharia. And by the way, Phil, I'm going to interrupt myself here. You guys, Phil, can you go with me 5 minutes more?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to take this break 5 minutes longer. So you say that Tillerson is driving, I understand, that Tillerson is driving this move to sort of sit down and talk with the Taliban. That's kind of like, don't you think that's kind of like thinking that there could be some sort of peace between Israel and Palestine? Like this fantasy of brokering some kind of a peace deal between them?
They're all spokes on the same wheel. Tillerson already signaled what he intends to do, what his worldview is, by his memorandum of understanding called MOU. A month or so ago, he went to Qatar and he signed this memorandum of understanding with the leadership of Qatar, Qatar, and to fight, stop funding terrorism, in other words, financial support of terrorism, while the other Gulf states at the same moment were trying to pressure Qatar to break off their relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood. Qatar is harboring the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood in their country, people like Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi and Khalid Mashal and other top leaders of the Hamas and or the Muslim Brotherhood. So what Tillerson did was undermine the efforts of the entire Gulf region by going in and preempting the process, patting the guy on the back, so to speak, and signing a memorandum of understanding without acknowledging that they were the ones that were harboring these individuals. Now, how in the world are we going to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization if he just endorsed their efforts while they're harboring leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood? Not to mention the fact that Qatar is an ally with Turkey and Iran. What do you think the people in Turkey and Iran thought about when they were drinking tea and watched Tillerson sign that agreement with Qatar? They probably choked. They couldn't believe it because he just signed an authorization that allowed them to go on doing exactly what they've been doing all along. So that's a signal of his worldview vis-a-vis Muslim Brotherhood. And Hamas is part of Muslim Brotherhood. And other groups that are operating in the West Bank and or the Gaza are also affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. So how in the world are we going to sort this out if we can't even tell our right hand from our left hand?
You know, part of it's astonishing, Phil. I have to say, I sat next to this goes back to the ignorance of people in leadership, and I really believe it truly is ignorance. Now, Andy McCarthy casts it and I think he's right too, as willful blindness, but there's also a ton of ignorance. I remember sitting next to an FBI official on a plane from Chicago to Washington and just saying some very elementary things about Islam, and he had no clue. He didn't know what taqiyya was. He had no clue. He was a man, I'm not going to say who, but let's just say he was in a high position. He had no clue.
Had FBI officers, agents that used to sit with me when I did interviews as a CBP officer, Customs and Border Protection. Back in the good old days, we actually used to collaborate or cooperate together in 03, 04, 05 era. And this is a compliment. He said, "Mr. Haney, I learned more from you in this two-hour interview than I knew in my entire career." And I thought, well, that's a nice compliment. I'm glad you learned something. But then I thought, really? You learn more in 2 hours sitting with me, and you're a specialist in this area than in the whole rest of your career? And by the way, you might have seen me when I testified before Senator Cruz at the Willful Blindness hearings. That was the 28th of June last year, and actually held up pictures of the icons of the Muslim Brotherhood, Tablighi Jamaat, and the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America. For the first time in history, we actually had an opportunity to show Congress the nature of the threat we face. It's all on YouTube or C-SPAN. You can go back and take a look at it. And I give credit to Senator Cruz for having those hearings, but my question is, what's happened since? It's been more than a year, and we haven't done a single thing to take action on the things. Andrew McCarthy was on that panel with me, and we testified before the Senate the 28th of June last year and told them exactly what we're talking about now. And here we are a year later, the State Department is still cooperating with the Muslim Brotherhood. They can't seem to figure out what they want to do in the global arena. Our new policies in Afghanistan are exactly the same as our old policies. And meanwhile, Al-Qaeda version 3 has now coalesced into the biggest macro coalition organization that they've ever been since they started under Osama bin Laden. And do our foreign policy advisors know this? And I'm not sure they do.
Well, of course, McMaster, as the head of the National Security Council, which is supposed to be looking into all the aspects of this, he's tipped his hat to his own worldview and has stacked his National Security Council with Obama supporters. Advisors from that era has purged people that would have the same viewpoint as you and me, Phil. And so we know what's happening here. We also know that McMaster is ignoring the president's directives. So we are reaching critical mass here, and I don't know, as we send more of our young people, our soldiers, boys and girls, mostly boys, to Afghanistan, it is a tremendous concern. And we have a lot of military people listening today to this show. So,
yes.
Phil, what would you say to them? Seriously, you think deeply. Well, what would you say?
Well, the Bible says that wisdom pulls down strong towers. We're in a warfare situation here. How in the world can we fight effectively if we don't even know the nature of the threat we face? If we're going to send people in the foreign arena, then at least we need to understand the nature. Read the code of conduct and see exactly what they say. It blows apart the argument that jihad is something benign and that Islam is a religion of peace and there's nothing in the Quran that has to do with violence. It just shatters that whole argument. Just take a look at it. Evaluate it right at, take them at their word. If I'm going to err, I don't mind erring on the side of taking them at their word. That's what we should do. And so that's what I would suggest. Learn the nature, read this code of conduct, and find out what they are really saying, because it's going to have an effect on everything that we do, both domestically, in terms of our counterterrorism policy here, and in the global arena, both sides.
Yeah, Phil Haney, great to talk to you. Also the author of See Something, Say Nothing, where he spells out a lot of what he alluded to today, and that memorandum of understanding. We'll put a link to that on our Facebook page on both of those things so that you can read it. Also, the article that talks about this meeting in Israel, counterterrorism meeting, we'll put that on our Facebook page too so that you can read it and share it. Phil Haney, thank you so much and for your service and for your friendship, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. Thanks, everyone.
Okay. All right, Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Corner. In spite of a misplaced endorsement by President Trump and over $30 million poured into the race in favor of his opponent by Mitch McConnell and his regressive friends, Judge Roy Moore beat the brakes off of Luther Strange in the Republican primary special election race to fill the United States Senate seat formerly held by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Hopefully, this will put the president and the D.C. labyrinth on notice that the American people are serious and committed to wresting our country from the clutches of the swamp rats.
Listen to the Hamilton Corner, weekdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Central on AFR. For more from Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
For generations, America's social relationships were governed by the Ten Commandments. We were taught to honor God, to not murder, commit adultery, or steal, and to not lie against our neighbor or covet what they have. Today's commandments tell us not to hate people or be racist and practice equality and tolerance. All laudable goals, but something's missing. They fail to acknowledge accountability to God as a starting place for better relationships. People who love God are more apt to love their neighbor. I'm Pastor John Miller. Visit me at churchontherock.org.
Hello, friends. Michael Youssef here from Leading the Way. God has used the American Family Association in many incredible ways, and I am so thankful for their impact on this nation. Through the mission and the efforts of AFA, Christians have been given the tools that they need to stand firm for the truth. And I just want to say congratulations to the entire team as they celebrate 40 years of faithful ministry.
Here for your encouragement and your walk with God. This is David Wolin with Haven Ministries, inviting you to anchor your day in God's Word. Infertility is no laughing matter, but Abraham and Sarah had been childless for so long that when God told him it was time and soon they would have a son, Abraham laughed. He was 100 years old. Sarah was 90. And the text doesn't tell us for sure, but I think that laughter was joyful. Abraham wasn't doubting God. He had believed and kept faith for many decades, and now God's promises were coming true. Romans 4:18 tells us that even when there was no reason for hope, Abraham kept hoping, believing that he would become the father of many nations. And God kept that promise. Through Christ, all who believe are part of that same family. Get daily insights into God's Word with Anchor Devotional. Visit getanchor.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. This week, America loses a national treasure, inexplicably just when we need the country's most knowledgeable and influential minds advising about how to protect against a potentially imminent nation-ending peril. The Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Threat Commission is being shut down. For 17 years under the leadership of President Reagan's science advisor, Dr. William Graham, this Blue Ribbon panel has warned that we had to protect our electric grid against just the sorts of EMP attacks North Korea is now threatening to unleash upon us. Successive administrations and the electric utilities have shamefully failed to heed those warnings and take corrective action. Consequently, we could experience on a national scale the sort of devastating, protracted blackouts now afflicting Puerto Rico. President Trump should give Dr. Graham and his team a new mandate as a presidential commission to oversee the immediate implementation of their recommendations. This is Frank Affney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Tax reform will protect low-income and middle-income households, not the wealthy and well-connected. They can call me all they want. It's not going to help.
For all of us, this is a now or never moment.
I hope that there will be some Democrats who are willing to work with us.
This is Wealthfare, helping those of great wealth with more tax breaks.
If I could say it as simple as possible, I would say that this tax reform conversation is about hashtag keep yo money.
All right, so that's Senator Tim Scott, keep yo money. And of course, it's the tax... The whole movement to redo the tax code and to lower tax rates that's a big story. And you'll say, well, why didn't I talk about it? Well, just because of time. And we will talk about it at greater depth. But let me just say this, that the House Freedom Caucus is actually supporting this. The framework that's come out, that's been issued, that's been released, the rates, both the rates and also just the proposals for bringing businesses, you know, bringing resources back home. They say there's over $1 trillion in assets from businesses that are offshore right now that they'd like to bring back home because of it would create jobs and also bring in a lot of tax revenue. Some say enough possibly to offset the loss in tax revenue by giving people tax cuts. So that's just part of it. And maybe I haven't asked him, but maybe we can get Congressman Dave Brett to join us to talk about this in greater detail because he is, after all, an economics professor, and I trust his judgment. So we'll have a fuller discussion of that. You're going to be hearing a lot about it in the coming days, no question about it. Well, this morning on Fox and Friends, Pete Hegseth had a few minutes with President Trump. They talked about a number of things, but I just thought this particular portion of it was interesting. It's about the NFL protests. Here it is.
The NFL cannot disrespect our country. They cannot disrespect our flag or our national anthem. And they can't have people sitting down or kneeling down during our national anthem. And I saw this a year ago with Kaepernick, and I said, this is a terrible thing. I thought it was terrible. And then it builds up a little bit and a little bit more, and you see what's been happening, and then all of a sudden you see more and more and more. And I came out and I made a statement in Alabama the other day, and I said, I think it's very disrespectful to our country. And the world picked it up. And guess what? Most people agree with me. And the NFL's in a box. They have to do something about it. They're disrespecting. And when I say they, in a way it is they, because they can stop it. You know, they have rules for everything. You can't dance in the end zone. You can't wear the pink socks relative to breast cancer, which one of the places. They have rules for everything. Why aren't they honoring this country by enforcing a rule that's been in existence for a long time? So the NFL and the players really have to do the honor of the country. It's for the honor of the country. They have to respect our country. They have to respect our flag and our anthem.
What prompted that in Alabama?
Well, I have so many friends that are owners, and they're in a box. I mean, I've spoken to a couple of them. They say, we are in a situation where we have to do something. I think they're afraid of their players. You want to know the truth. And I think it's disgraceful. And they've got to be tough, and they've got to be smart, because you look at the ratings are going way down. The stadiums are, I've seen a couple of stadiums over the last few weeks. They are losing. There are a lot of empty seats. I couldn't even believe it. But when it comes to the respect of our nation, when it comes to the respect of our anthem and our flag, they have no choice. You have to have people stand with respect.
Yes, I agree. And I, you know, the confusion of the NFL players and their lack of knowledge, you know, they know a lot about football, but they certainly are not clear thinking about this. Because when you equate the playing of the national anthem and the display of the flag with the president, when you somehow think that they are synonymous, that they mean the same thing, that if you stand for the national anthem, you're supporting a president that you don't prefer. It has, the flag transcends all of that, and they don't know it. They honestly don't know it. And then also, the fact that you would have to choose between loyalty to your team and loyalty to the country. You think of the veteran that stood, the Pittsburgh Steeler, who stood in the walkway and with his hand over his heart, 3 terms in Afghanistan. Now he's apologizing for coming out and putting his hand over his heart because he betrayed his teammates. You mean really he has to choose? He has to choose between loving his country and loving his teammates? Really? What kind of thinking? It just shows you the ignorance. And I don't mean that. I mean, but that has nothing to do with color either. We have raised a nation of ignorant people who know nothing about their foundings, who know nothing about what that flag means, who know nothing about what that anthem means and why it was written and what it actually means. They actually think that standing for that flag, which represents freedom, a new way of viewing the world, the equality of all men, is somehow racist. It's just bizarre. And the fact that this started with Colin Kaepernick, who is, by the way, not a role model for anyone. He is the guy who wore cops are pig socks on his feet. He was protesting in favor of Black Lives Matter and against policemen. So really, the NFL, black and white, there are some great guys. It doesn't have anything to do with color. They really hate police. They would stand and they have to choose between team loyalty and hating and disregarding the police and what they're trying to do. It's just a false choice, and they are putting people in a terrible position. I want to say that we're hearing now the Patriots are going to stand this weekend in their game against the Carolina Panthers, and one of their players, whose name escapes me, here it is, it's Devin McCourty, had this to say. Let's listen.
We wanted to come together, and you know, first and foremost, we hate that people's going to see it as that we don't respect the military and the men and women that are way braver than us, that go and put their life on the line every day for us to have the right to play football. And we know people are going to see it that way. And, you know, guys have family members, fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters that serve. And they were really conflicted about it. But we just want to send a message of unity and being together and, you know, not standing for the disrespect and, you know, different ways guys felt and so many different things going through a lot of guys' heads. And it was unique to see guys kind of come together and bond together as a group before the game and do that. But I think all of us want a message that goes out of unity, being together. Obviously, as a team and also as a fraternity of NFL players, guys talked throughout the league about that. And it was great to be a part of a lot of guys trying to do the right thing. Obviously, it won't be seen as the right thing to everybody. But I think in our hearts, what we focused on the most was that we were trying to do the right thing today. And I'm proud of our guys, and I'm proud of the group and the guys I get to go out there and play football with. They're all great guys. They're better people than they are football players.
All right, so to me, that's an example. Again, that's Patriots safety, Devin McCourty. That's an example of a really nice guy who really does want to do the right thing. But his confusion is absolutely on display for everyone to see, and he's just verbalizing what I think is going on behind the scenes. I don't think that these players have... They're exceptions. I don't think they have a clue about their own history and about what America means, the ideals of America. I think it was Abraham Lincoln, maybe Teddy Roosevelt, who said that. I think it's Teddy Roosevelt who said the thing about America is that anyone of any color and creed can be an American, because America is formed around a set of ideals, not around tribal customs or whatever. It's a set of ideals. Based in the Judeo-Christian understanding of who God is, and then a constitution that was laid out to make sure to establish that all men are free and created equal. And of course, we've had struggles with that. Not that hasn't panned out practically, but it is the ideal. And it's certainly, listen, thousands, hundreds of thousands gave their lives in the Civil War over this issue. This is, I remember Dinesh D'Souza said, the thing that's so great about America, it's not that America had, the thing is not that America had slavery, it's that America did away with slavery and brought black Americans into a parity. And you can argue with that all you want, but I have to say the black middle class has grown tremendously, tremendous opportunities. We have made such progress. Do not let the left divide black and white Americans. We are family. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.